Welcome to Behind the Case, an ACG Case Reports Journal podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Abbas, co-editor-in-chief of the ACG Case Reports Journal. Each month, we highlight unique and educational cases, speak directly with the authors, and most importantly, focus on practical insights that you can apply to your own clinical practice. Let's dive into today's case. Today's case is titled Triple Endoscopic Hemostatic Therapy for a Life-Threatening Duodenal Variceal Bleeding. This case highlights a challenging clinical scenario, ectopic duodenal varices in the setting of myelofibrosis-related portal hypertension with persistent bleeding despite IR-guided embolization. Ultimately, this required escalation to multimodal endoscopic therapy, including topical hemostatic agents. We're joined today by Dr. Arjun Chatterjee, who is a second-year gastroenterology fellow at the Cleveland Clinic and associate editor for the ACG Case Reports Journal. He has a strong interest in medical pancreatology. And we're also joined by Dr. Hassan Siddiqui, who is an interventional endoscopist at the Cleveland Clinic with a passion in medical education, particularly in video-based cases. And we're very happy and lucky to have you both join us today. Arjun, I'll start with you. Could you please walk us through the case, including the patient's presentation, key findings, and what made this case particularly challenging?
Thank you, Daniel, for that kind introduction. And thank you, Dr. Siddiqui, for joining us for this presentation of ours. So the case is fairly interesting. We had a 71-year-old male patient with portal hypertension, but this was secondary to myelofibrosis, like you said. The portal vein, thrombosis, and then this patient presented with melena and a hemoglobin of 5 gram. Over the course of the hospital stay, he had received 15 units of blood. CTA was done when he initially came in. That did not show any active bleeding. And then we proceeded to get tagged red blood cell scan, which showed some localized bleeding in the duodenum. Patient was sent to IR for embolization, and that failed, unfortunately. And emergent bedside endoscopy was performed, which had shown bleeding duodenal varices in the duodenal bulb, and also non-bleeding GOVI2. So we had called in our advanced endoscopist, Dr. Siddiqui, and then he had performed an injection of 2 cc's of cyanoacrylate glue through a 23-gauge needle, but unfortunately, this did not work. So since the patient was still bleeding despite us injecting glue, next we had applied topical self-assembling peptide hydrogel or Puristat. It gave us like some temporary control. To ensure that we have good control of bleeding, next, Dr. Siddiqui mixed the glue, so 2 cc's of N-butyl cyanoacrylate, which was mixed with 0.5 cc's of ethoxidized oil, and then both mixture was injected into the duodenal varices. And then after the bleeding had stopped, we had also applied a powder spray of succinic anhydrate, which is a hemospray, and then it formed a nice gel on contact with blood. And then this ultimately achieved hemostasis. And the follow-up endoscopy a few days later had shown bleeding was completely under control and the lesion had healed.
Thanks, Arjun, for presenting that case. And it's very fascinating to how this case was managed, particularly life-threatening duodenal ectopic variceal bleeding. Dr. Siddiqui, I'd love to start with your overall approach. When you encounter patients with bleeding, ectopic duodenal varices, what is your approach as far as the initial decision tree, endoscopy versus IR versus EUS-guided evaluation?
Hey, thank you, Daniel, and thank you, Arjun. I want to say when you approach a patient with a question of bleeding related to portal hypertension, you have to think about the pathophysiology. So generally speaking, when we think about portal hypertension, what comes in your mind is liver-related cirrhosis or fibrosis, and immediately your thought comes to esophagus varices. But there's more to portal hypertension than just liver disease. So initially, when you are evaluating the patient, I think taking a good history and physical will lead you to the correct diagnosis. So for instance, our patient had portal hypertension related to a primary hematological disorder and not so much primary liver disease. The patient may have liver disease along with a hematological disorder, but the driving force here for the portal hypertension is a myelofibrosis MDS type picture. The patient had MDS for many years, which had not transformed. So immediately your mind should go, well, if it's non-cirrhotic portal hypertension, it could be varices anywhere, right? Because it's not just the short gastric veins, which are kind of feeding the vessels. So that's why we proceeded with thorough imaging, including a tagged RBC scan, which pointed it towards the right direction, which was the duodenum instead of the esophagus or the stomach. So once you know that this is likely a variceal bleed and this is likely in the small bowel, you should be directed to the direction, but maybe you will start with something straightforward, something standard, for instance, banding, but may or may not work. For instance, banding frequently does not work for gastric varices. So that should lead you to a more thorough discussion with your radiological colleagues, with your hematological colleagues, with your advanced endoscopist, that when you are approaching this patient, what should we do because our standard techniques may not work. So that's why we had a detailed discussion with the primary team, with the ICU team, with the hematological team, and with radiology, and we proceeded with a radiology approach first because, you know, these are multifocal varices. Even though you're seeing something in the duodenum, you're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, right? Because they are also in the stomach, they're also in the small bowel. And there is no guarantee that when you approach this one particular varix, there is not another four. They are going to pop open tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. So that's what our rationale was, to go with radiology first. And I think they tried their best. But for them, the challenge is if there is already thrombosis in the feeding vessels, they may or may not be able to approach this particular varix that's bleeding. So that's what happened. They tried their best, but because of multifocal thrombosis, they were just not able to target this vessel. So that leaves us back, the ball is back in our court, right? So radiology try, now we have to do something to save the life of the patient. So in an ideal world where you have all the resources available, you would bring the patient to the endoscopy suite, you would do an endoscopic ultrasound, you would measure which varix is under high pressure, where is the feeder vessel, the afferent vessel, the efferent vessel. But both me and you and Arjun knows that life is not ideal scenario, right? So the patient is not on pressors. Patient cannot come down to endoscopy suite because there is a hemodynamic instability. The patient is getting multiple units of blood. So we have to do something bedside. Then the next approach would be, well, what do I have in my bleeder cart that I can do bedside immediately right now, right there? So then you have to go to your ABCs of GI bleed control, and there are several guidelines, including ACG, which has excellent algorithm. And it boils down to there is something you can inject. There is something you can mechanically close, like a clip, which can be through the scope or over the scope. There is something that you can burn with, such as bipolar or coag rasper or APC, right? There is something you can apply topically, like hemospray or peptides. So now you know this is my toolbox, and I have to use one or more than one things in the toolbox to combine them to give the patient the best treatment possible. So that's how I approach this patient.
Yeah, thank you for walking us through the mechanistic understanding, what the source is, and how do you collaborate with your colleagues in terms of understanding what is it the best that you can offer. And as you mentioned, like, you know, we really have to sort of improvise and innovate to help our patients the best with our, you know, toolbox, and particularly understanding that sometimes we may not have these advanced techniques available at our you know, centers or in our community. So this brings us to a good transition about using topical glue-based agents that you had used. So let's talk about cyanoacrylate. It remains a cornerstone of therapy, but it's still off-label in the United States. What are the most important practical risks clinicians need to understand before using this glue in their patients?
I really encourage your readers and whoever's listening to this podcast to really look into, like, how does cyanoacrylate actually work? So the pathophysiology behind that is that it has bonding, that it polymerizes. And the key concept to understand is how long does it take for this agent to polymerize? And you want that sweet spot where it doesn't take too long for it to polymerize, so that it doesn't embolize and kind of escape the varix, but also it can be not milliseconds, right? Because it's going to polymerize either in your hand when you have it drawn into a injection needle or in the actual syringe. So you really need that sweet spot between 30 seconds to a minute where you're able to push it through a needle. You are able to have it polymerize inside the varix and there is minimal embolization, especially because you're doing this somewhat blindly without using fluoroscopy. So intervention radiology have this capability of seeing if it starts to embolize so they would stop. But you know, you don't have that because the patient is in ICU and your bedside. So that's why we frequently mix cyanoacrylate with ethiodized oil. What the oil does, it increases the polymerization time, which in simple words, the glue will take longer time to solidify. But if you add too much oil, then it will be very long time and there will be a higher risk for this glue to embolize. And who knows where this is going to go, right? It can frequently go to the lungs, but it can also go to other places. If the patient has patent foramen ovale, it can go to the brain and polymerize there. So depending on the size of the varix and what kind of injector needle you are using, you will be the best judge of how much oil to mix with the cyanoacrylate, and that will how you will control the polymerization time. So in our patient, even though this varix is under high pressure, but the actual size of the varix in terms of the cubic size, the volume inside the varix is low. So I added a very small amount of oil, so it's not too long for it to polymerize. I use ethiodized oil, but there's other oils available on the market. I was trained at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We used to use poppy seed oil. But regardless of what oil it is, all you're doing is controlling the amount of time it takes for the glue to solidify. I also use a 23-gauge needle. There's also a 22-gauge needle on the market. So now you have to weigh. If you use a large bore needle, you're going to make a bigger hole in the varix, but it may be easier to push the glue. So I found that 23 gauge is like the sweet spot where you're not making a bigger hole in the varix, but you still have enough pushing capability to push the glue in. Now, the other classic teaching is wherever you see the nipple sign where likely the varix opened up and bled, you want to go just a few millimeters away from it. You don't want to go right inside the nipple sign. You may or may not be able to do that, but I think there is some effort you should put, especially in a gastric varix. When you retroflex and you see that this big varix with a nipple sign, just go a few millimeters away from the nipple sign.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting those key nuances and this technical details. This brings us to a good point in terms of early career attendings who are beginning to learn this technique of glue-based injection. What advice would you give them in terms of selecting their patients, especially the first few cases that you attempt this technique on?
I would say, I think a gastric varix would be a good place to start instead of a duodenal varix. It is very key that you examine the upper endoscope that you're going to use. A lot of these scopes, after multiple years of use, do not have a good retroflexion. So in our unit, there is this joke called the bendy-bendy scope, coined by famous Dr. Sanaka, but make sure your scope has a full retroflexion, right? So before even you put the scope in, make sure you test the scope. If it's nicely retroflexing, you can go ahead and proceed. There's multiple needles on the market. I like to use a 23-gauge needle. There's also a 22-gauge needle. You can start with either. Then once you've examined the varix, I would draw the glue. But now that you have the glue drawn in a syringe, when you attach it to the injector needle, make sure the injector needle is flushed with saline first, because you don't want to put a bunch of air inside the varix. And then when you push the glue, let's say you are doing 1 cc, you are probably going to use the entire 1 cc glue within the channel of the needle. So now the syringe is empty, but the glue has still not entered the varix because it's inside the sheath of the needle, because the needle itself is 120 centimeter long, or maybe even more. Now you have to push the glue with more saline, about 1 cc, so that it's entirely out of the actual needle inside the varix. Once you do that, you will see some puffing of the varix, and that would confirm that the agent, whether it's cyanoacrylate or histocryl, has been delivered inside the varix. And now your heart rate is going to go up right? Because either you have to tell the nurse needle in, or either you have to withdraw the scope with the needle sticking out. My recommendation is you ask the nurse to put the needle in, but keep the sheath against the point of entry with some tamponade pressure, and then stay there for at least 30 seconds, 2 minutes. And sometimes 2 minutes seems like the longest amount of time, because you do want to detach your sheath and see the amazing work you did. But I recommend you keep your pressure or tamponade with the sheath against the site of entry with the needle withdrawn. And after 30 seconds to 2 minutes, you slowly pull away. You almost always see and visualize some oozing. Please don't freak out. Just watch it for 5 minutes. If you have delivered the entire 1 or 2 cc of glue, I promise this oozing will stop on its own. It is expected. You can wash a little bit. And once the oozing has stopped after 5 minutes, you can take a nice picture and come out. Now, in our case, things did not go as planned. So I highly encourage you to watch the video. So as soon as I withdraw the needle, I keep the tamponade. And once I withdraw the sheath, there is a gush of blood. So I know whatever I did not work. So now you have to go to your plan B and your plan C, which could be anything that you have, right? Because it's 2 in the morning or it's 3 p.m. You are what the patient has as a next line of defense. By the time you call someone else, call IR, call advanced endoscopist, like, the patient may not survive. So now you have to see what you have. It could be anything. It could be a clip. It could be a bander. In our case, we tried not to do thermal therapy because you don't want to burn a varix. Clipping would have been not very effective in the duodenal bulb. So we went with this peptide self-assembling agent. I put a caps. If you see the video, you will see that after the glue did not work, I came out of the mouth. I put the cap on. So later half of the video, you will see there's a cap. And the reason why I put a cap is that you can keep the self-assembling peptide on the surface of the varix for at least 5 minutes. Now, the classic teaching is that the quantity of this peptide is not what is most effective. So you just need a thin layer of this peptide. So 1 cc is not better than 3 cc, as long as you have a thin layer of the self-assembling peptide. But you have to keep it applied for a significant amount of time, which could be at least 5 minutes. And then we went in with the topical agent of the hemospray, and we had good control of bleeding. Actually, if you look at the packet insert, they do mention that if you apply a lot of this self-assembling peptide gel, it actually may work against you because it may slide off. So you just want a thin layer.
Yeah, this brings us into a great segue into using the powder-based agents for rare shield bleeding. As they say, you know, it's not approved for this indication, but as you know, the big theme is working and improvising with what you have available in an emergency-based setting. So this is very good for clinicians to take away from, and, you know, how this was used as rescue. So could you please talk a little bit about, like, what happened in terms of your decision-making to use this after 2 glue-based injections?
I assume you're talking about the spray agent.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the few technicalities about it is that if you look at the literature, the best response to spray agents is actually in malignant disease, especially these bulky gastric tumors. So if you look at the 30-day outcomes, they're not that great for peptic ulcers, for AVMs, for Dulofoys, but they're actually very good for large, bulky, oozy tumors. So I think the reason behind that is that when you look at the ulcer, the source of bleeding is a larger caliber vessel in the submucosa versus sort of these bulky tumors, which has more sort of widespread, superficial, multifocal bleeding areas. So I think that's where the hemospray really kind of works well. In our case, because using thermal therapy in a varix always sounds a little bizarre, you know, you just kind of not burn a bigger hole in a varix with a nipple sign, which is actively bleeding. And clipping is not practical when the varix is in the gastric fundus, especially. So that leaves you with these topical agents, you know, which are kind of easy to use, low risk, they can cover a wide area, and you don't really need to be that accurate when you're spraying it. because there is a bigger square footage that you can get with these agents. So that's kind of what our rationale was. I can tell you that there are multiple cases that have been referred to me for EUS guided coiling of a gastric varices, and I go in and there is like this lonely clip living its sad life on top of a varix. So that's one thing that I really want you and the other upcoming future gastroenterology leaders to kind of look at the clinical history, look at the story, and you will know retrospectively, like this was not a bleeding ulcer, this was a varix. So if you take a good history and good physical, if you look at the labs, the platelets are low, if the patient has portal hypertension, if the patient has a history of acute necrotic pancreatitis, and after that, the patient started bleeding in the fundus, especially if you see a patient who was fine and then all of a sudden had very large volume bleeding, and the gastroenterologist went in and there was large clot in the fundus and they couldn't visualize the fundus, but the gastric body and antrum were cleared and were normal, you should immediately think of, whoa, it could be a varix, right? So that's one thing I really want you to encourage your readers to kind of understand, that the history and the physical will lead you to the right diagnosis, which should lead you to the right treatment. So the wrong treatment here would be assuming that whatever is going on in the fundus is an ulcer and you put a clip on it.
Yeah, thank you so much for emphasizing the importance of a thorough evaluation. And thank you for just going into the details of the technical aspects and in terms of recognizing the big picture and working with what you have. And, you know, we really appreciate your time. And we thank Arjun for joining us today for this really insightful discussion. So if you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to read this full case and watch the video and learn from it. And you can find the full details of this case in the ACG Case Reports Journal. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Arjun. Thank you, Daniel.